This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and to entertain you a little along the way. In the news, a congressional report is critical of aviation safety in the FAA. The Air Force flies a U-2 with an AI co-pilot. Precision airdrops as a service. Special deliveries with Antonov AN-124s and a Chinese Saad ramjet hypersonic propulsion system. Also, the world's first female aeronautical engineer, airline emissions statistics, flying through smoke, and earplugs on a C-130. It's all coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 633 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me this episode is Max Trescott. He's host of Aviation News Talk Podcast. He's a national CFI of the year, and of course, he's an expert on learning to fly or purchase a Cirrus aircraft.
Hey there, Max. And I'm curious, did you see the Grand Conjunction?
No, I saw clouds.
Oh, it's so cool to see. I've seen it on a couple of nights now. I think as we're recording here, it's supposed to be the closest that our view of what Saturn and Jupiter has been aligned in 400 or 800 years, depending upon which measure you're using. But it looks pretty cool. Looks like a double star out there.
Wow. Well, I'm sorry I missed it, but yeah, all cloudy here. David Vanderhoof is also with us. He's our aviation historian. David, how are you doing?
I'm good, and I'm like with Max. I couldn't see it. It's cloudy and ugly here, but looking forward to a good show. It's hard to believe that it's the end of 2020, but you know what? Goodbye and good riddance.
Yeah, you know, yeah. Our last show for the year, I think. But also with us is Rob Mark. He's senior editor of Flying Magazine, and he's also publisher of the Jetwine blog.
Hey, good evening to everybody, and Merry Christmas, Happy Holiday, and thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it's good to have you here with us. All right, well, why don't we get started right away with some of the aviation news from the past week. We've got some stories that we picked, we've got some stories that other contributors picked, and we've also got some stories that you, the listeners, picked, and so it's an interesting roundup of current aviation events, so... Are you guys ready?
Ready from the West.
Yeah.
All right, we have some whistleblower-related news this week that came up in congressional testimony. We see from Reuters, Boeing, quote, inappropriately coached pilots in 737 MAX testing. And what we have is the U.S. Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation. They released a committee investigation report titled Aviation Safety Oversight. And it was prepared by the committee Republican staff. We'll have a link to that oversight report in the show notes. And in testimony, whistleblowers were critical of Boeing and the FAA. The report says that with respect to this year's testing of the MCAS system, Boeing officials, quote, had established a predetermined outcome to reaffirm a long-held human factor assumption related to pilot reaction time. It appears, it goes on, in this instance, FAA and Boeing were attempting to cover up important information that may have contributed to the 737 MAX tragedies. So, that's a pretty serious accusation.
Yeah, it certainly is. And, of course, this report follows up on the one from the House of a few months back that took the Democratic leadership there, or I should say the Democrat leadership in the House wrote the same kind of a report with some other perspectives, but they didn't go into this aspect of it. And what really makes this interesting, I mean, the gist of it is that they basically coach people on the test before, at least that's what the report is alleging. And that before the test pilots went out and flew the MAX, they said, hey, guys, remember those switches at the bottom of the power pedestal that turn off the trim motor? Don't forget that those are important to go for as soon as you get any indication of an MCAS failure, right? Add foot stomping noise at this point. So, of course, honestly, it would have helped back in, let's see, when did we get the first report? I think before the second crash, Boeing released some data or some updates to their checklist that said pilots could experience something that reacts like a trim failure and be ready for that. It would have been nice even then if they'd said, hey, guys, we suspect this, you know, MCAS system, the easiest, the best, the most permanent way to disable the trim motor is to hit those two buttons, the two switches down there at the bottom of the throttle quadrant, and it will completely turn the power off to the trim motor. But they didn't even say that to the crews, and that was before the second accident. And they're still dinking around with this, trying to pretend like, well, we kind of thought that pilots would get it. You know, they're pretty smart people. They're trained in the airplane. They know what's going on. And when they see this, they're going to say, oh, it looks like a trim failure. I know what to do with that. And lo and behold, the pilots did not react the way that Boeing expected them to, at least not the pilots for Ethiopia and for Lion Air. Now, we don't know how U.S. crews may have reacted to the same situation. That's an unknown. But the point is that Boeing and FAA were way too close together, as we've been talking about now for, you know, nigh on to 2 years. The news just keeps getting worse for Boeing all the time.
It does. It does. And from the human factors standpoint, I think part of the conversation has been some assumptions that had been made relative to pilot reaction time to a variety of different inputs. And that assumption has been called into question by some as maybe needing some revision. I mean, if you inundate anyone with warnings and buzzers and, you know, multiple things going on at the same time, that impacts reaction time because the brain's got to process all that. Granted, pilots, I think, are trained maybe better than the general public to navigate through those kinds of situations, but still it's an issue.
Well, and I think that people that are not familiar with the problem, not just on the Boeing, but on any large transport category airplane, might not realize that when there's an alert for something, it doesn't necessarily mean that the airplane is only saying, hey, wake up, I think there's a problem with the trim system here. I mean, there may be all kinds of other warnings, both visually and orally, that can and realize this is going to happen like that. And the crew has no warning at all that anything is coming. And there's the startle factor to deal with, which is somebody going, what the hell is that? What's going on here? And that wastes a few seconds. And, you know, having I was lucky enough to fly a guy we had on the show a year or two ago that wrote the Air France book, Bill Palmer. He flies for one of the majors. He was nice enough to take me through the simulator up in Minneapolis at the time on the A330 and showed me what it was probably like inside that cockpit when those guys lost control of the airplane. And I was sitting in the jump seat watching all the alerts and the oral warnings and the lights. And I went, holy shit. I mean,
yeah, it was pretty.
And again, yeah, it was scary to me, and I knew it was coming. I didn't know what to do, but I'm just saying that when it's nighttime, it doesn't matter. When you're in the clouds or something like that and this happens, it just makes it even worse. So Boeing really blew it by just assuming that this was so minuscule a product that the pilots didn't even need to know about it and they didn't need any training on it.
Now, Southwest Airlines also plays a part in what's been going on in these congressional hearings. Daily Beast has an article, Southwest Airlines allegedly cut corners, pilots struggled to get planes to take off. And this also came from a whistleblower, one who was in this case working as an FAA safety inspector at a Southwest base. And he alleges that the Southwest Performance Weight and Balance System, PWB, was flawed, that the system that was introduced in 2017, but Southwest removed some of the safety buffers, they were termed as, in this calculation, and with the result that some pilots were reporting difficulty getting the aircraft airborne. Now, weight and balance is kind of a critical thing to get right. And I think, all the airlines have a system, algorithms that take into account a variety of different factors. And, of course, the result of this is that you're trying to minimize the risk of there being a problem. Max T, maybe you can comment a little bit about weight and balance.
Well, it's fundamental. There are limits within which an aircraft is allowed to operate. And if you're outside those limits, then you are a test pilot. Nobody wants to be a test pilot.
Now, a spokesman for Southwest, spokesperson, Brandy King, told the Daily Beast, we discovered a discrepancy between data systems involving the weight of a number of aircraft earlier this year. Southwest took immediate actions to prevent a recurrence, which included notifying the FAA, correcting the data discrepancies, and launching a daily audit to review each of the impacted systems. But still, there are pilots out there apparently who are suggesting that maybe in an effort to, minimize costs or increase efficiency, that the safety buffers around some of these parameters was reduced to the point where they had difficulty flying the airplane at times. I don't know. The whistleblower accusations, I think, range all the way from accurate representations of what happened to sometimes employees who are dissatisfied with the company for whatever reason or have a perception of the facts that's different. And so, there's no way for us here to evaluate that, but these are what are being alleged. And Congress isn't happy about it.
Well, I think one thing you touched on earlier when you mentioned this story was that Southwest's spokesman, Brandy King, acknowledged that there was a problem with the software, that there was some of the weights on some of the airplanes, once it was called to their attention, they found out were not accurate and that they took action to fix it. Now, that doesn't mean that there wasn't something else going on, but that's where the story gets a little thin, because the story doesn't really dig into anything other than whistleblowers said. But like you said, Max, I mean, whistleblowers could mean almost anything. I have one fellow I used to fly with that still flies for Southwest. And this guy complains more than anybody I've ever met. For a guy that's a captain on the airplane, he is never happy. It doesn't matter what the company does, he's never happy. And but then I know an awful lot of people at Southwest who are extremely happy. And one other thing, I say this sort of hedging my bet, but, you know, Southwest has a terrific safety record, and I realize that just because you have not had an accident doesn't mean that everything you're doing is safe. But it is a general indication, I think, over how long has Southwest been in business? 50 years?
40 years, something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they're doing quite a few things right. But also, I think I wish I had a chance to go back up and look on the ASRS site, the NASA site, to see if any pilots had filed any reports about this so that they could have some sort of immunity. Because no captain wants to sign for an airplane and then have a deal somewhere along the way and be talking to the principal operations inspector from the FAA later, and the guy says, "So you knew about this, and you did this? You took off anyway with the airplane?" "Well, yeah. I mean, I work for the airline. I gotta do it. You know, it doesn't work that way." So that's why I'm just saying, I'm not saying the report is wrong. I'm just saying we have to take it a bit with a grain of salt because there are so few details on this.
Yeah, I agree. I agree completely. There's also another aspect to this report that I find fascinating, which is the congressional relationship with the FAA. And I just want to read a few paragraphs from the report because I think it's really instructive. But the report says, and it starts out talking about the genesis of this committee investigating airline safety. And it says, in April of 2019, weeks after the second of two tragic crashes of Boeing 737 MAX aircraft, U.S. Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation staff began receiving information from whistleblowers, plural, detailing numerous concerns related to aviation safety. Commerce Committee Chairman Roger Wicker directed staff to begin an oversight investigation. The scope and breadth of the investigation quickly expanded beyond the first allegations inspired by the 737 MAX tragedies. Information received from, here we go, 57 whistleblowers revealed common themes among the allegations, including insufficient training, improper certification, FAA management acting favorably toward operators, and management undermining of frontline inspectors. The investigation revealed that these trends were often accompanied by retaliation against those who report safety violations and a lack of effective oversight, resulting in a failed FAA safety management culture. And then in support, and here's where the relationship with the FAA comes in. In support of the committee's investigation, Chairman Wicker sent 7 letters, which included 30 specific requests for information from the FAA. To date, more than half the requested information remains unanswered or incomplete. Committee staff have reviewed approximately 13,000 pages of documents over the course of the investigation. Some of the correspondence in response to the chairman's letters appeared to be contradictory and misleading. As a result of the slow response to document requests, Chairman Wicker requested 21 FAA employees be made available for interview by committee staff. Over the 20-month investigation, committee staff were permitted to interview less than half the employees requested. The documents received and the FAA employee interviews conducted produced inconsistencies, contradictions, and in one case, possible lack of candor. So, I mean, this is kind of amazing. This speaks to a much larger issue, I think.
I think it does, but then let's be serious. We have seen this administration ignore subpoenas. Quite a few subpoenas for various members of the government over the last 4 years. And I think what is maybe more, at least it's amazing to me, I mean, if one of us got subpoenaed for something, we'd be in court because we would have ended up in jail for contempt if we didn't show up. But somehow people in the government have, under certain situations, have felt perfectly fine just ignoring the subpoenas and or requests from various people in Congress to provide more information on a topic. So this doesn't surprise me all that much. But it will be interesting to see if this kind of behavior continues with the next administration. Maybe it will, maybe it won't.
Yeah. Well, as I said, we'll have a link to the report in the show notes at airplanegeeks.com/633. We could actually go into it in even more detail and depth, but I think we'll move on to some other topics. But there is information in the summary concerning sort of deficiencies, issues that the committee has concluded, as well as some recommendations that include things like a review of FAA compliance philosophy and effectiveness, tightening up the complaint investigation process, education on whistleblower rights and prohibitions on retaliation, and a number of other things. And you can find that all in the report. So, yeah, I guess mostly I hope something productive comes of this, because it kind of speaks to some, general failures of the, overall safety process.
Sure, more than we've ever seen from either one of these organizations on their own, but the two of them together, let's face it, we're also dealing with a public health crisis around the world that seems to put almost every other topic on hold. So, again, I hope we don't see any more of this.
Yeah. All right. Well, we will move on, and we have an item from military.com. Air Force U-2 surveillance plane flies first mission with AI co-pilot. David, this is pretty pretty exciting, pretty interesting. I think it sounds fascinating.
Let's start with, we're talking about a 50-year-old aircraft. The Air Force a couple weeks ago actually announced that they were going to have a special announcement about the U-2. The U-2 is mission capable, is a single seat. Well, they provided a assistant, an artificial intelligence, which goes by the name of R2MU, or otherwise known as R2, named after my favorite droid on the planet, R2-D2 from Star Wars. And it's an apt name because, for all intents and purposes, this R2 did the same thing as what R2 does in an X-Wing. The pilot flew the aircraft while R2 navigated for it and provided the sensor operations and other functions, and looked out for missile launches while the pilot scanned the cockpit. So they worked together to perform the mission. So much like R2-D2, he was the navigator, and basically you took part of the workload from a U-2 pilot, which flying the airplane is difficult enough, but operating all the sensors and the cameras, etc., reduces the workload and reduces the stress and provides more accuracy. So it's a really neat step forward for the Air Force.
Now, the article mentions that the AI was trained with 500,000 simulations. So I take that to mean they're talking about some kind of, machine learning process where they present the AI with, simulations of different scenarios, and the AI learns how to respond to them. But it is, I don't know, Max, AI has come a long way since, in the last 20 years. 20 years ago, we used to write AI programs, using a computer language whose name escapes me at the moment. What was that called? I can't remember. But anyway, it's just a series of if-then kind of statements. If this, then that. If this, then that. And that sort of thing. And we're in the world of machine learning in a completely different way. Lisp, that's what it was called. We used to program in Lisp.
Yeah, these days I think AI is so smart that it goes beyond the ability of people to program all of those if-then statements, but they're actually using machine learning to teach itself. And I think a good example of that is some of the voice recognition that we see these days. You know, voice recognition used to be terrible not that many years ago. And then suddenly just a few years ago, wow, it got to be really good. So yeah, we're seeing AI being used in many different places.
Have you guys watched any of that series on Fox called Next?
No.
Oh, you should watch it. It's on the regular Fox channel, but it's in the same kind of genre as, say, the series 24 was years ago. And but it's about just that, a computer that develops its own persona, and it learns from itself every moment and keeps expanding and growing more and more powerful and starts doing bad things to people that want to shut it down because it has access to automobiles and smart devices and people's homes and offices and workplaces and aircraft. And it's kind of interesting. So anyway, but that's just my two cents. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, the other important aspect of this story is where the software came from, which is the gaming industry. The radar system was operated by U0 gaming algorithms to operate the radar. So it's interesting that the gaming world is now moving into the real world. So as far as artificial intelligence goes, on UAV Digest last week, we talked about new warrant officers for the drone program. The Navy wants younger people to join that program because they're more inclined to be able to operate systems like video games. So the reality is becoming fantasy and fantasy is becoming reality, and it's all going to be a PS3 game eventually or a PS5 game.
Yeah, if you can find one for Christmas. But interesting stuff.
I wondered if when the pilot had a problem, how he interacted with this AI.
Yeah, what was the interface? Yeah.
Do you know, David?
No.
Okay.
That would be interesting. I don't think talking to him directly was going to work. So, but I'm sure there was a keyboard interface. Even if you watch Star Wars, when R2-C2 chirps in the X-wing, a translation comes up in the box on his way to Dagobah on one of the monitors in the X-wing. So I'm sure it's that kind of similar system. And keep in mind that the AI was monitored from the ground. So if there had to been a communication issue, there was somebody on the ground that they could speak to.
I was just wondering if somehow the pilot had a googly answer or something like that. But
Well, I heard a story a couple of years ago, and I don't know if this is true or not. Someone's got to fact check this. But I heard the story that they connected two AIs together so that they could communicate with each other. And they started communicating using the, I'll call it, language that the programmers had established or whatever. But that over time, the two AIs developed their own language and started communicating back and forth. I hope this isn't a movie I read about. Communicated back and forth using this language that the humans could no longer understand. So they got kind of apprehensive about that, pulled the plugs on the AIs, and that was the end of that. But somebody fact check that for me. I don't know if that's true. All right, that's getting way off topic. We have a couple of sort of breaking news as we record this. I guess the COVID bill, the relief bill, was that signed today? Because it included some.
No,
it was not. But it does include, I guess, some support for airlines and airports, doesn't it?
Yeah, it. I think the House and the Senate were supposed to be voting on it tonight. In fact, as we're speaking, whether they did or not, I don't know. But I'm sure David's up on that. That we'd have known if President Trump had signed it. But there is indeed some paycheck protection money in there for the airlines. and for airports. But of course, I think, you know, I mean, it's I'd say anything is going to be valuable. But of course, when it really would have been valuable was October 1st, before the airlines laid off tens of thousands of people. I'm not sure how this will work for people that are already off, other than maybe providing them that extra amount of cash for their unemployment. But actually, you know, I'm thinking about it. When they're on furlough, they're not. Are they getting unemployment if they're furloughed? I know if they're fired, they get unemployment. But you know, that's
being furloughed, I am collecting unemployment. That answers your question, Rob.
Oh yes, okay. There you go.
And Max, check the show notes. I put your link to your story that about the Facebook chatbots.
Oh, it does exist, huh? Okay.
Chatbot. 2017, 3 years.
Oh, okay. All right. Also, sort of associated with COVID and all, we see that there's a mutation, I guess, of the coronavirus in the UK, and that's causing a lot of countries to shut off transportation with the UK, which, of course, is affecting the airlines quite a bit. We've been seeing news stories in the press that travel is, well, not up to previous year levels, but holiday travel is, you know, fairly decent. And now we have this that's going to put a damper on that, I would suspect. So the airlines aren't out of the woods, that's for sure.
And New York joined the multiple countries throughout New York State. Governor Cuomo got Delta, Virgin, and British Airways to insist that everyone test negative for COVID before flying them to New York. So I'm sure that's the first state, but I'm sure that here in Pennsylvania and other gateway points will be probably doing the same thing, since it started in New York. But I'm sure Pennsylvania and probably Illinois and some of the other gateway states for Europe will probably follow suit.
And I talked to Launchpad a couple nights ago, and he's been caught up in this as well. He is flying to Germany, where he will then have to quarantine for, I can't remember if it's 10 or 14 days. So that's pretty common. I know here in California, we've got some quarantine restrictions as well. I think if we travel more than 150 miles from our home, I believe we then need to self-quarantine for some period of time.
All right, let's talk about some of the news stories that listeners sent in, because we've got some really interesting stuff. Lyman sent in a story from TechCrunch. Dash Systems raises $8 million for precision airdrops as a service at distant or disaster-stricken destinations. And we talk about this concept of the last mile delivery. As David and I know from UAV Digest, we're always talking about that delivery by drones for the last mile. But what about the middle mile? Dash Systems wants to expedite the middle mile with airdrops like you'd see performed by the military. Their tagline is land the package, not the plane. And what they want to do is drop pallets of parcels at their penultimate destinations, no matter how inaccessible that location is. And they're trying to develop a system that's, I guess, more efficient and quicker than typical air-based delivery. They note that when you order from Amazon or something of that sort, items go from the warehouse to the airport, then a large, typically cargo plane delivers the packages to a major hub. And then trucks, or maybe smaller planes in some cases, transport packages to a regional sorting or distribution facility, and then local delivery trucks take the package to you. But Dash wants to step in with the step three here, the trucks transporting packages to a regional sorting or distribution facility, and do those with airdrops. And their idea is a plane. And I think, is that, I don't know if you guys looked at the article, is that a Cessna Caravan that they're using there or demonstrating with? But
that's my best guess.
They put these packages in pods. They call them pods. And so a single flight can drop multiple pods at multiple destinations. And these pods have actual control surfaces and a tail kit, they say, and a method of slowing down and landing. So basically the plane flies by, dumps the pod out, and the pod fly, you know, with the packages for that town or that disaster area or whatever it is, flies itself down to the location.
Falcon 9.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the Falcon 9, you know, it's Falcon 9's got the retro rockets and the stabilizing fins so it can land back down. So the technology is surprisingly doable now. I don't know how small these pods are, but given what we've seen from SpaceX, the technology's there.
The pods that they're using now have a capacity of 50 pounds of cargo each, but that's just kind of their starting point. So really interesting article. We'll have a link to Dash Systems in the show notes, of course, as well as the article.
And I'm thinking that DoorDash may adopt this technology. I'd love to just order a pizza and have it come, you know, flying down out of the sky.
Yeah. And then we got an article, actually it's in Jet Tip, and it came from Nick Benson from Jet Tip. And the title of the story is Swirl In Aircraft, Irregular Antonov Flights Deliver Relief to Phoenix Laxative Factory. So I was like, what's this? Well, Antonov Airlines, they've been operating some kind of curious flights between Mumbai and Phoenix using, so far, three AN-124s. And as this piece was published, a fourth AN-124 was en route. And there was a lot of speculation as to what are these planes delivering. Of course, these AN-124s are huge. But in the Jet Tip piece, they've uncovered the true mission. It reads, the Avgeek rumor mill provided some hints at its cargo, with people saying it was carrying silica, seeds, or medicine. The payload, however, is tons and tons of psyllium, which is a plant grown in India. The primary use for psyllium is as a fibrous laxative. And it's also the main ingredient of Metamucil, which is manufactured in, guess where? Phoenix. So there's huge quantities of Metamucil raw material arriving from India with these AN-124s.
Hard to believe that the only place they can get this stuff is in India in the quantities that would make it feasible to stuff them on a 124 and fly them halfway around the world. You'd have thought they could order that on Amazon or something.
Well, in all fairness, Rob, 124s are probably one of the only things available. I mean, everybody else is probably booked. It's the holiday season, you know, and UPS and FedEx and everybody else can't keep up with the demand because everybody's online shipping this year.
Yeah, that's a good point.
On top of everything else. So Antonov Airlines probably is available. I mean, and you're making less flights. They're probably doing less flights with the bigger volume.
The AN-124 can carry a payload of 330,000 pounds, which is more than anything else. The 747-8F can carry 304,000 pounds, not as much. C-5M, 281,000 pounds. So the 124 is, that's a high-capacity plane. There's also a great photograph of the 124 in this article. If if you're you know, sort of beyond the humor of the laxative story, that the photo of the 124 is really nice, and it the caption is a laxative laden Antonov AN-124 departing MSP for PHX. So check that out. And then Patrick Wiggins sent us an article. This is from Haggerty.com. The Queen of the Hurricanes drove a Model A Roadster. And this is a story about a woman that I was unaware of, Elsie McGill. I know, David, if you're familiar with her history, but she's reported to be the world's first female aeronautical engineer, born in Vancouver in 1905. She wore leg braces because of polio. And at one point, she was even told that she would never walk again. But she became the chief aeronautical engineer at Canadian Car and Foundry, in charge of the design and construction of the Maple Leaf 2 training biplane. And the Maple Leaf 2, it was the world's first aircraft designed and built by a woman. But she also, interestingly enough, was tasked with retooling the Cancar factory to mass produce the Hawker Hurricane during the war. And she was responsible for coming up with a winterized version of the Hawker Hurricane that actually had had skis. But the article, it goes on and on. She died in 1980 at the age of 75 and was posthumously inducted into the Canadian Aviation Hall of Fame in 1983. Just a remarkable aviator, a remarkable engineer, and a really, really fascinating piece. I mean, it's a long article, and you just keep reading more and more and more about what this individual did. So thanks, Patrick, for passing that on. Encourage you to check out the article, link in the show notes. All right. John Arvin sent an item from Popular Mechanics, the experimental engine that could get us anywhere in the world in 2 hours. All right, that's fast. How do you get anywhere in the world in 2 hours? Hey, Mach 16. How do you get to Mach 16? Well, the Chinese are working on something called a SOD ramjet. S-O-D ramjet stands for Standing Oblique Detonation. And it is a ramjet engine, but I guess theoretically can reach Mach 16. The Chinese have built a demonstrator that's reached Mach 9 in a wind tunnel. And this is actually an old concept. It uses shock waves produced in the engine using these standing oblique detonation methods in the combustors. But it's a really, well, the article raises the question, how come no one's been developing these things in the past? And the answer is kind of is, well, they're so complicated and it's difficult to test these things to create the conditions necessary to sustain this kind of propulsion that it's never really been carried along very far. But fascinating article.
I think what's probably making it even more difficult is that in one part of that, it talks about the researchers are working on. It says they're working on stellarators along with tokamaks. And I thought when I read that, I said, are these made up words? Or I had no idea what those things were until I clicked on the links. But they've got some pretty heavy duty scientific language. So I figured for sure you'd understand all that, Max.
You know, somehow I knew you were going to say that. And honestly, I don't completely. It is pretty complex. Although, as opposed to ramjets and scramjets, where you've got to, you know, achieve a certain velocity before the engine lights up, it talks about these being able to take off horizontally from an airport runway. There's a report in the Chinese Journal of Aeronautics that explains a lot of this and why this thing is so complex. It says the standing oblique detonation in combustors will take a complex structure developed from shock reflections, shock boundary interaction, and combustion instability due to the confined flow passage. Therefore, it becomes a very difficult task to make an oblique detonation stationary at the required position in the SOD combustor. Also, there's a lack of proper wind tunnel being capable of reproducing true hypersonic flight conditions necessary for testing the SOD engine in full scale. Therefore, the ground facility for hypersonic propulsion testing has been a challenge for Mach numbers higher than 8 for decades. But, you know, the prospects is kind of amazing. It says, with reusable trans-atmospheric planes, we can take off horizontally from an airport runway, accelerate into orbit around the Earth, then re-enter into the atmosphere and finally land at an airport. And that's what scientists say from the Chinese Academy of Science, Sciences Institute of Mechanics in this study. In this way, space access will become reliable, routine, and affordable. So definitely future tech stuff, not something that's going to happen next year.
You know, Max, you know what that you just sounded like to me?
Uh-oh.
What? On that? Womp, 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 womp. It was like, okay, I lost it after the first sentence.
Oh, man.
So if we lost any of you listeners out there, we're really sorry, but we'll be more than happy to provide an expert explanation. Just send Max an email at thegeeks at Airplane Geeks. All right. Well, anyway.
Hi, I'm Jackson, and you're listening to my favorite podcast, the Airplane Geeks Podcast.
What's up with the geeks? Rob, what's up with you? Anything interesting?
Oh, man. What a Christmas I have had in a year when most of the rest of the life has kind of, can I say sucked on here?
Yeah, sure. You can these days. Oh, okay. 20 years ago, no, but.
Okay. Well, I got a very interesting letter from being in Illinois. I got a letter from our state government in Springfield, and it was I opened it up, and it turns out – I won't go into the whole story because people have to go to jetwine.com, and they'll be able to read up all the details there. But I found out that I am going to be inducted into the Illinois Aviation Hall of Fame next year.
No kidding.
And yeah, so I was just – when I first read it, I thought, is this addressed to me? You know, did they get the wrong guy? Yeah. But it's really when I looked at the list of the other people, historic Octave Chanute was an early member of the Illinois Aviation Hall of Fame because he passed here in Chicago many years ago, but of course he worked with the Wright brothers on some of their early designs. And this is, of course, pre-Wright Brothers. I should say pre-Wright Brothers flyer. But anyway, it was just – it was kind of cool because I found out I actually knew a number of people that are already inductees. And it happened sometime next year. I don't know when and I don't know where because – no one else does because of COVID-19. So when it happens, I will let all of you know, and everybody is free to join us for this celebration, and the first round is on me.
Ooh, all right. Now I'm interested.
Okay.
No, seriously, congratulations, Rob. That's
yeah, it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. I'm pretty proud of that.
It is pretty cool. All right. What else? Is going on. We had a note from Launchpad that he was going to send a report from flying to Europe, and I think he might have forgotten to attach the report to the email because I don't have a report.
Well, you know what we could do? We could make it up, and we could sort of express it
yeah.
the way we think he would have said it.
So how was his flight, Rob?
Oh, I think it was marvelous. He was in coach. And, of course, coach for launch pad is always excruciating because, what is he, about 6'4", I think, or something?
He's about as tall as David and about three times around.
Yeah. But he was traveling by.
That's because David's really skinny. That's because David's really skinny.
Yeah, okay.
But I think Launchpad would have probably brought one of his stuffed animals with for the long flight.
Mm. Emotional support.
Yes, an emotional support doll.
Stuffy.
Stuffy. Mm. I think he would have probably had a few. Now, I wonder what airline he would have flown. Do you think he would have necessarily flown Lufthansa? Because
I think he probably would have flown Lufthansa. Let's say he did.
Well, Christine, he has a special exemption in case people are saying, well, how did he get to Europe if nobody from America can go to Europe because of COVID? But he has a special dispensation because he's a federal employee, I believe, or a federal contractor, I should say, attached to a group in Germany. And so it's like going to work for him, I guess, or something along those lines.
Plus, he's a Texan, and everyone loves Texans.
That's true. That is true.
Don't forget that he bribed the flight attendants with chocolate.
With chocolates, no doubt.
Excellent, excellent point. Actually, I don't even know who's flying where anymore out of the U.S. to Europe. I mean, most of the airlines are so cut back on those flights.
So if and I've tried to contact Launchpad, so if he does get my message and if he's someplace where he can send me the report before we publish it, here it is.
Hello, Airplane Geeks listeners. Your reporter at large, Launchpad Marzari, with a quick pie rep on traveling international in this period of COVID. I started out at the Austin airport. I went up to the Delta lounge, lots of spacing, everybody in masks, lots of safety issues, didn't feel problems at all there. The flight with Delta, there was the middle seat had been blocked out. I had an exit row seat and they just come by and hand you a baggie with water and a cracker and a cookie in it. Everyone was wearing masks. It felt very safe on the airplane and pretty safe in the lounge. In Atlanta, where I had to change planes, shout out to the Delta clerks there who were having to deal with multiple international rule sets that were changing daily for COVID requirements because we were only flying through Amsterdam to make connections onto other countries. So we had to have Dutch paperwork and German paperwork, and other people were going on to the Middle East. They had to have different paperwork and tests, and the Delta people were doing a really good job of trying to keep it all straight and while doing social distancing. There at the airport, when we were having to deal with the Delta counters, they were having to remind people to keep their distance, but it still felt safe. On the airplane again, the middle seats were all blocked off. I had an exit row seat. Everyone kept their masks on. Everyone stayed seated. We got fed, but the difference being instead of pouring you a drink, they just handed it to you like a whole bottle of water or a whole can of Coke. Flying with the middle seat empty was very comfortable. Landed in Holland, had to go through Holland customs and then be tagged as international transient. So I had to go to another different wing and it was actually pretty easy. The whole flight actually felt not much more other than the paperwork at the beginning. And again, a shout out to Delta to having to deal with the fact that countries are changing their protocol procedures on a weekly, if not daily basis. It was all pretty safe. And a big shout out to flight attendant Amber, who is our newest Airplane Geeks podcast subscriber listener, and she's interested in continuing her aviation education because she thinks aviation is cool. So big shout out for Amber. Keep going. This is your reporter at large, frequency change approved. And of course, Merry Christmas to all our listeners.
All right. Well, hey, Brian Coleman sent in an article. It's titled Flying Dirty: Why Airlines Emissions Rise Even When They Try to Cut. And this comes from something called OZY.com. It's an older article from May, and there's a lot of information in there. But trying to parse this, it says that carbon emissions per revenue seat mile are down, but total emissions are up. Pre-pandemic, of course, because of the number of people flying. They note that emissions per passenger mile flown have dropped by about 50% since 1990, which is a lot. But the number of passengers who've flown has grown 150% in even shorter period since 2004. They also conclude that what's really needed is reporting transparency because, and we've seen this, some airlines use carbon offset credits to factor into their claims of carbon neutrality. But what the airlines don't do is they don't report on the effectiveness of those credits, of those investments. So if an airline says, well, yeah, we're going to plant, a million trees, and so we get so much credit, did the million trees get planted? Was the investment that they made in order to earn the credit producing the results expected? So they talk about that. And another point they make is that the commitments that have been made to alternative fuels, biofuels and so forth, they call them, quote, minuscule. There's a lot of stuff in that article, but again, we'll have that in the show notes. I'll link to that in the show notes if you are interested in, the issue of emissions. It did get me thinking, what's the right metric? Is it carbon emissions per revenue seat mile or, per passenger? Or is it just total amount? What's the important statistic here?
Well, and of course, one thing that we're going to have to remember is that eventually carbon offsets aren't going to be enough. I mean, if we're going to meet any kind of global emission standards, airlines, operators, everybody is going to have to start operating with equipment that produces fewer emissions. And because, like I said, the carbon offsets only go so far.
On to some listener mail. Frank sent in an interesting question. Frank lives in northeastern Pennsylvania, and he's seen smoke in the sky that came across the country from Trescott's wildfires out there and on the left coast. And he asks an interesting question. I mean, he says that, okay, We see how you don't want to fly through volcanic ash, for example, from an eruption, right? That's incredibly corrosive, and it's the particulate size is high. And if you want a good way to shut down a jet engine, fly through a volcanic ash plume. But what about these wildfires and the smoke generated from them? Do those damage engines? Does that smoke represent an issue for flying?
I would think that at some level, if you did it enough, that yeah, it could be potentially dangerous. I was just talking today with a pilot who was also a flight instructor, who said that he was out getting a lot of instrument practice during the smoke, and he said that he started feeling as if he had perhaps caught something. And he was worried initially that he had caught COVID, but he said that being in the smoke that much affected his lungs for about a 2-month period of time. So not only does it affect airplanes, it affects people in airplanes flying in that smoke as well.
Well, sure. I think about it when you see firefighters these days, when they go into a building, I grant you the smoke and the noxious gases are pretty intense inside a burning building, but they're wearing full protection gear that, you know, to protect them from breathing in any of that stuff, because it'll kill them. So I would think that even if you're out in a cirrus doing practice approaches in some kind of smoke after enough time, yeah, I can see where that would get to your body.
Yeah, I mean, that smoke is ash, right? It's leftover stuff from a burned tree. And, you know, you get enough of that, that's not going to be great for the oil of your aircraft and certainly not great for your lungs.
And, of course, it doesn't help with visibility. So, you know, there's that issue as well. So, yeah, if anyone listening, if you have any more detail, scientific detail, something about, you know, flying in the kind of smoke that's generated from wildfires or, you know, burning vegetation, send it along. I mean,
guys.
Mm-hmm.
Jet airliners are fire bombers all the time and are flying through the smoke.
Yes. Yeah. So I don't think, at least for a jet engine, I think it depends on how thick the smoke is and if that affects the, you know, the oxygen content of what's, you know, the inlet air to the engine. But I don't think it is hugely harmful if it's not too thick, unlike volcanic ash, which is a different animal altogether. But yeah, fire bombers fly through it.
Well, and usually all the video I see of them shows them kind of above the smoke, to the side of the smoke. I don't, and yes, there are times when at the end of the run they may end up, you know, going through it. But I think probably the majority of those operations are, you know, VFR, and you know, fortunately they're not, you know, flying through the smoke all the time.
Yeah, those are the guys who we should ask the question of.
I was just thinking the same thing. I wonder if they're on oxygen even when they're down low in some of these fires. Yeah, because, I mean, if we can think of that, I mean, I would imagine that they're dealing with it.
Yeah.
It would be an interesting thing to find out.
Yeah. All right, we also heard from Bill. He said, just heard you chatting with Adam Spink. Please have him back. I'd like to hear how he does those air shows with a crappy American radio and pencil and paper. But he also talks about the C-130. He says the C-130 marriage story was fun. And when Max T added his clarification that the ceremony was done on the ground, quote, for obvious reasons, I was sure he would mention the noise. Can you imagine taking your vows, leaning in close and yelling, what?
Was that yes or no, you said?
Yeah, yeah. What was that answer? So Bill said he rode on a C-130 many times when he was a mechanic in the Air Force in the 80s. This is a great story. He said, once just before engine start, the loadmaster came back and handed out yellow foam earplugs to the dozen or so passengers on the flight. Ambient noise was still high enough to preclude easy conversation, and one passenger clearly didn't understand what those yellow things were for.
He put must him in have his nose, right?
That was my first thought.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But that's not it. He must have assumed from context, airplane ride, plastic package with small things in it, that they were a snack, and tentatively popped one in his mouth. The loadmaster caught it and broke out with a huge grin. Once those big Allisons spooled up, we were all glad to have the hearing protection. So, yeah, great. Great story, humorous story. Good way to end the episode.
130s are loud.
I bet they're quite loud.
Having been in them, yeah, they're loud. But when you're a young kid like I was, it was exciting. It wasn't deafening.
Yeah.
Yeah, you didn't care.
No, not when you're, at that point in your life. So I was going to mention before, but I forgot. So I listened to the recordings that I had made of the F-35 demo team flight and the F-16. I've got some interesting recordings from some T-6 Texans, maybe a few other things from my little trip to Florida, and I'm gonna make those available somehow. If I get really carried away, since we're going to skip next week and not have an episode, I might even make that an episode. So that'd be, you know, for truly geeky, listen to a fighter jet air show demonstration. That might be it, but maybe I'll make them available otherwise. But
and you drove to Florida. Why was there any particular reason?
Yeah,
to go for an air show.
To go see the F-35.
Oh, I see. I didn't realize you went down there just for that. Okay.
Well, that was why I went down. It ended up being a 3,200-mile trip. But, I ended up camping in all three of the national forests that are in Florida. I learned that Florida in the wintertime is a great place to be. And then I come back to a foot of snow in New England. So,
What are the three national forests in Florida?
There's Ocala, there's Osceola.
And then the Everglades.
Apalachicola.
Oh, wow. Didn't know that.
Trescott, the Everglades isn't a forest.
No,
I know. Believe me, I have flown over it. I've landed at airports next to it. I was kidding. I just thought that the image of you camping out there in the Everglades fighting off the pythons was a...
Crocodile Rock?
Yeah, exactly.
There are no pythons out there.
I think they pulled a few out of the swamps.
Actually, there are, I think, thousands and thousands of them. I just read a story this week that they've trained a dog to smell them, and that's kind of their latest technique for detecting pythons.
Rob, they actually got – people have released them.
Yeah, I thought of that after
evasive,
I said it.
They're evasive species, so – and there's also a Discovery show about, you know, you can watch them hunt down the pythons in one of the shows.
Yeah, but you know what the real training issue was when they taught those dogs to smell them out was to get the dogs to stand up and hold their noses with a paw so they knew that there was one close by. That was – now, let me tell you, that took some training.
Yeah, I bet. All right. Thanks for listening.
This is really true. You guys think I'm making this up. You're not going to have me back on here again, are you? Okay, that's all right. It's been nice, folks.
All right. Thanks for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. This will probably be the last episode for 2020. You know, a year where even just aviation-wise, a lot of things happened. And I think first episode in January, we'll look back at some of the, hopefully focus on the good things that happened, I mean, in this past year, if we can find any. So you can look forward to that. Find us, as always, at airplanegeeks.com. We have show notes there for this and every episode. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, just visit airplanegeeks.com/633. And our email, which we're still a little bit behind on, is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. All right, Max Trescott, where do folks find you?
Oh, they know by now. I'm just going to give my end of the year Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays.
Yes, all right. David, any closing messages?
Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Kwanzaa, Happy New Year. Just remember, if you think 2020 is bad, wait till it becomes 2021 and starts drinking.
Okay, that's good. I like that. I like that one.
Anything else, Rob?
No, they'll find me at they'll find Scott Spangler and I at jetwine.com, and you'll find all the cool details about me being made a cool big what do you call it when you're in the Hall of Fame? Is that a big mucky muck or is that a big kahuna or something like that? I don't know.
Swelled head.
Swelled head, yes, but also at Flying Magazine. So happy holidays, everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. And please join us again next time as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
I forgot what I usually say here.
Goodbye, everybody.
See you next year, and thanks for listening.